Father, we do bow before you this morning and say thank you for this day. Thank you for the sunshine and all the beauty around us, Lord. We thank you for this good world you've created and placed us in and given to us. Lord, we pray that we would respond to your good gifts in the right way, Lord, with gratitude in the way we live, the way we love you and love one another. So as we turn to your word and try to search out what truths it has for us, Lord, we pray you give us understanding and bless this time together. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, so how many of you guys did the homework on Deuteronomy chapter 8? All right. How many of you knew what you were doing when you were doing the homework on chapter 8? Not slightly less. Okay, about the same amount. All right, so the assignment was faith versus evil, just like the other ones. But it was about the time in the wilderness, right? And of course, there's more passages that relate to that than Deuteronomy 8. But Deuteronomy 8 was the passage that kind of helps you pull it all together as you think about it. So tell me about, go ahead. Sure, yeah. Mm-hmm. Always turn off phones before you come to class, especially if you're the one teaching it. Okay, so yeah, that's right. You can, as with any of these, you can use a Bible dictionary and get the background, you know, to help you kind of get the overview and other passages and things like that. So, tell me, if you were in the wilderness for 40 years wandering around, what would have been the temptation for you to stop fearing God, worshiping God, and all that? Trusting God, what would have been the challenge to your faith that during that time? Can you describe that for us?
Daniel. How long it was.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. Yeah, the length of time. And remember, what was going on? There was the generation of adults, and mainly the adult men of fighting age, who got up to the edge of the promised land the first time and said, no, we don't trust God that he's going to give us this land and help us beat the giants and everything else, so we're not going in. That group of people, the judgment was that they were going to wander the wilderness until they died. So you have a pretty significant group, the older group, who is all, they've been sentenced to death, basically, and they're all going to die in the wilderness. And it's the next generation, then, when you get to Deuteronomy, it's the next generation, which Moses has right there on the border again. He's bringing everything back to their remembrance and saying, you know, this time, be faithful and trust God. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so, and are you seeing yourself as one of the people who would have been at, like, fighting age at the first time? Now, what do you guys think? Do you think that group of people had a conversion, so to speak, to where they were not trusting God, and that's why, because of their unbelief, they were lost, basically. They perished because of their unbelief, it says in Hebrews. So, do you think any of those had a conversion as a result of the judgment? Or did they basically just stay cynical, no longer trust God, and just kind of wander around until they died in the wilderness? It's a good question, right? Where could they have gone, though? Yeah. Right. Yeah. But that's a picture of unbelief, though, isn't it? Because, you know, on the one hand, they are complaining about not wanting to go in the promised land, but they didn't really go back to Egypt either. So, yeah, exactly. It's the attitude of just being a complainer that, you know, is where they were at. All right, so now, what does Deuteronomy 8 kind of tell you about the basis for faith? Because this group of people, the new generation, they had to go through that time too, right? So they spent a lot of years wandering around in the desert as well. So on what basis should they be trusting God at this point? What kind of things does Moses talk about in this chapter? Steve.
Moses is an
So, anybody else have anything on that? Very good, yeah. So can you see the difference between cause and purpose from God's perspective? Okay, like on the one hand, you can ask questions when you're in a situation like, you know, difficult like that, being in the desert. Why did this happen? And there, the only answer you could have from this whole scene is that, well, it happened because of the unbelief of, you know, our parents, basically. So the reason or the cause doesn't really give you any comfort. But what we see in that chapter is that despite the cause of it, God still has a good purpose that he's carrying out to humble them, to teach them, and to prepare them so that they will be able to enter the promised land. Isn't that cool? How even though the reason was bad and it was totally their fault, God still had a purpose that he was bringing about through it. So, and that's an important truth that we got to keep through Job as well, is that, you know, it's not about the cause as of the suffering and things like that as much as it is about what does God have for us in this situation. And, you know, you can take a bad situation and God is still so great that he can work out good results from it. Yeah.
I like how they say, like,
yeah, it does. And he was thinking of this, obviously, when he was in the wilderness being tested as well. So any other thoughts on the fact that Jesus had his wilderness experience where he was tested and learned to depend on God? Yeah. Yeah, that's good. So I wonder, too, because, you know, following up on that idea, I wonder if the new generation did have a choice whether to just bail on the whole wilderness wandering altogether and go somewhere else. Because with Jesus, that was the temptation, is trying to get his own provision apart from relying on God for it, you know. And so if he's related to that and then we relate to him, I wonder if that's part of what was going on in the original setting as well. Whether they had to, you know, exercise their faith in God by staying there, staying with the group in the wilderness, waiting for the chance to enter the promised land again. Maybe they could have just left altogether and said, I'm no longer part of this community, and go somewhere else. All right, well, we have one faith versus evil left, and it's on your friend Job. You guys know that guy, right? So, and that's not due next week. It's due, I think, the week after. So, for today, though, we want to break up into some groups, and here's how it'll work, all right? Let me explain to you what the purpose is. How many of you guys did read the chapters 32 to 37? All right. You didn't?
You didn't answer.
Well, yes, I guess so. Everybody else needs to read it. But you do need to read it by the time the course is done, because, you know, that's a pretty major part of your grade. Reading it the second time through, and you'll be tested on that, or asked whether or not you did it, how much of it you did. Okay, so today I have some handouts for you. Can I have some volunteers pass these out? Three, Alex, and one more. Okay, those of you who read the chapters, do you already have some ideas as to whether you favor Elihu or against him? Raise your hand if you kind of favor him at this point. You think he was right on. You got one? Anybody think he was way off? You're not going to go so far as to say he's perfect? Okay, a mixture? A mixture, okay. Well, when you report on stuff, you can share both. You can share good and bad if you're not dogmatic one way or the other. Different topics from the other guys? Yes. Right. Okay, so let me explain what we're going to do in the next few minutes here. Listen up good. So that we don't want to waste any time, okay? So first of all, when you get in your groups, make sure you stay focused. Don't get distracted with chit-chat and all that stuff, because time is essential to doing this. Did anybody not get one of these sheets? Okay, good. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to split into groups of about no less than 5, no more than 8, okay? So 5 to 8 people in your group. And you can go anywhere as long as you don't disturb the next class over, and you can stay within earshot of the door right here. Okay, that means you can go straight downstairs if you get there quickly. You can go, around close by here. We need to be back in our seats at 9:45. Okay, back in your seats at 9:45. And what are you going to do while you get in your group? Here's what you're trying to do. You're going to go through the chapters, 32 to 37, and basically you're going to go through one chapter at a time. So everybody, reading together, you can have somebody in your group read the chapter if you want, if it goes quick enough. But otherwise, just scan through, and then each of you just contribute some things that you see that seem to be wrong, false, or just man's wisdom. And then contribute things that you notice in that chapter as you go straight down that are right, true, and God's wisdom. So what you do is say, in verse whatever, he says this, which seems to be wrong. Or he says this, which seems to be right. Okay? Does everybody understand that much? Okay? So you stay on topic. Keep it organized by going straight down through and just offer the things that come to mind. Try to get as many people involved as possible. And one thing you want to do is have a representative from your group who will be able to come up and share what you guys found. Okay? Make sense? And then at the end of today, after we do that part, then I'll try to do some summaries and things like that, maybe, and try to recap. Maybe go through the, kind of an exposition straight through if there's time for it. But if not, we'll either skip that or do it next week or something like that and reshuffle the schedule. Okay? So have fun. Let's get a fiery debate going here. And be back in your seats at 9:45. All right, you guys are moving way too slow already. Get in those groups. Thank you.
I will not show partiality to any man or use flattery to
right, does everyone have someone to represent your group? Okay, go ahead and go. Well, you know, to tell you the truth, is everybody in this room or is any group outside? Everybody's in here? You guys can stay where you are, stay with your group, so we can, yeah, that's actually fine. So, all right, you guys ready? What's that? You guys need a potty break or something? All right, go ahead and get up and come back in 5 minutes. Here we go. Let the fire descend. Are you guys in agreement or disagreement? Are you guys both going to come up? You can if you want to. Yeah. One of you can go, and then the other one can come and fill in any extra information. Got the workaholics over here. They don't take their breaks. They don't study. Well, you can keep thinking through it. Okay, so how many groups did we end up with? Are you guys one group right here, these two tables? You guys are another group? Okay. 3, 4, 5, and 6, right? 6 groups, yeah. Okay. Ooh, look at that. Pretty snazzy. Wow. It's very advanced. It's like a tablet and all that stuff. Yeah. All right, guys. So let's start with group one. Who is your representative over here who's going to come and share your findings with us? Corey? Okay. So give respect to whoever is teaching at the time. When they finish presenting what they know, you could give them a question or something like that and see if they know. You can go ahead and ask a question of the person speaking. If somebody from your group, if you feel like they left out some things, then another person from that same group can come and follow up a little bit too, okay? So let's just see how it goes here. Corey. Okay. I will jot down. I'll try to fill this out a little bit as we go along.
All right. Yeah, I've put all of the notes all up here just in case I forget something. Okay. Well, we didn't get through all the chapters, but what we did get through, well, I'll share with. I'll start in 32. In verse 2 is that he seemed just angry still, was angry at Job and didn't seem like from the right heart necessarily where he's coming from. But at the same point, he started off waiting, like he seemed to be patient and not quick to speak but slow.
Would that be point four?
Those 2 points. That he waited, that'd be in favor.
What verse is that?
That'd be verse 4. Verse 2, or 32:2, that'd be more towards the wrong side because it was led by anger. I personally believe that, like, he, in his own eyes, he saw that, or he felt that he was being led by God, and, like, in verse 18, I guess that'd be, I don't know where to put that, I'm right or wrong, because no one can really say if he was or not truly being led, because we can think in ourselves that we are being led and constrained by the Spirit, but it could still be ourselves. but I think he was fully convinced that he was being led by the Spirit. 32 also for the right side would be verses 8 and 9, that wisdom's from God. And verses 8 through 11, he seems to be mocking Job's righteousness, that he still doesn't really believe that Job is righteous. Then 33, I'm just going to list all the ones that are wrong, actually. Sorry, I keep going back and forth. 33, 19 through 28, he still insists that Job's wrong. 34, 7 through 9, still accusing Job. 34, 11, it just seems to be telling him the same things that, or it was the principle of immediate retribution for things that he's doing wrong, just like his other friends were telling him.
That was 34:11.
Yeah, 34:11, I believe. Could have been 35. Yeah, 34:11. For according to the works of a man, he will repay him, and according to his ways, he will make it befall him. For right on the right side, they had confidence in what he had to say. I already said that. 33:3-4, he's just pointing out that, yeah, we're both men. He understood, it seemed like he had the right view of that no one was greater than somebody else. And then in 35, it seems, I don't know, to me, I kind of got that he was rebuking him for his attitude of that, well, I'm getting punished, so I might as well continue sinning, or I might as well sin. So he's kind of, I don't know, I see it as that he was saying that even if you claim to be sinless, you're having the wrong attitude of, well, I should, if I'm being judged, I might as well do the wrong action. That's kind of what I got from that. But I think that's all we got. Yes? Anything else? Do you want to add anything? Okay.
Still go through everything that we got, or how do you do it? If we got the same,
have to repeat,
the same similarities.
I'll say this: if we already have it on the board here, then you don't need to repeat it.
Okay.
So what would be the major point? I need to do this still, actually.
Okay.
What would be the major points from Corey's summary then? What are the major things that you guys also see that we can go ahead and get on the board to list them here? Major wrong things. Would you say his attitude, his anger at Job? The attitude toward Job is kind of the same as the other friends, and that's wrong? Okay. So that was, you got it from 32:2, but you can pick it up in other places, right? 32:2, anger. We could just say anger, because he was angry both at Job and at the friends, right? Why was he angry at the friends? They condemned Job, but couldn't prove that he was guilty. And why was he angry at Job? What does he say? Because Job was angry, was accusing God of injustice, basically. Right? Okay, so anger would be a point against. What about major right things? He waited to speak, right? That's kind of a good sign, right? 32:4. Waited to speak. What other major ones would be across the board for everybody? Yes, okay, right, 33:6. Equal with Job. They're both made from a piece of clay, right? Okay. Other on the wrong side would be, now this is where, try to be real specific with it, because, you know, we want to get zeroed in on exactly what the specific pieces of evidence are here. So he does talk about, and Corey went over a little bit, that, you know, Job is wrong in general, and 33, 19, 28, he's accusing Job, but, you know, it's hard to say, you know, definitively what he's accusing Job of, right? So let's go further with that in the next group of people that get up. Just try to, when you mention something negative, try to pin down specifically where and how he goes wrong. Okay. All right. Go ahead.
Lord. All right. For chapter 32, wrong, false. We got verses 6 and 10, kind of like almost the same thing. Elihu just wants to be heard and give his own opinion out of what he thinks is right. But he has his anger is same thing. But we kind of got a scripture that reminded us in James. It says, the wrath of man does not produce the righteousness of God. To go with that. For God wisdom, verse 8 is the breath of Almighty gives him, like God gives us breath. That's godly wisdom. Chapter 33, Elihu doesn't have authority to judge man. Alex, but he's so cocky. like that. Verse 19, not always the truth, because many wicked prosper. Get more into depth. Verse 33, man cannot teach man wisdom. Wisdom comes from God. Elihu has placed too much confidence in himself, self-righteousness. God's wisdom is in verse 12, God is greater than man. That's true. And verse 4, God has given us all life. It's good godly wisdom. Chapter 34, from the flesh, verse 4, you cannot judge for yourself what is right or choose what is just for yourself. That's from the flesh. Anybody disagree? Okay. Godly wisdom, verse 12, God will never do wickedly, nor will the Almighty pervert justice. And verse 21, God does see everything. He's sovereign. Chapter 35, from the flesh, Elihu gets mad at Job for trying to justify himself. Elihu prays. Is that how you say Elihu or Elihu? Okay.
Elihu's probably
close to the original. Okay, Elihu gets mad at Job for trying to justify himself. Elihu places words in Job's mouth, saying, I forgot what verse that was. Verse 2, yeah. Alex.
So is he like that Job said that, though?
No, Job didn't say any of that stuff. He's like basically saying, like, he condemns Job in a way of saying stuff. Of chapter 35. I think verse 2. I don't know what verse it was. He kind of started asking a question. Okay. And.
He actually did say things like that.
Who, Job?
29.
Oh.
Yeah, I think Elihu's pretty fair in his quotes of Job.
Yeah.
Actually. But if not, then that is a point against. But look at, I shall be condemned. Why then do I labor in vain? Because, what advantage have I? How am I better off than if I had sinned? So he is fair on how he quotes.
And
he just says, God has taken away my right. Job said that. And so,
okay. And we didn't get anything in godly wisdom from chapter 35.
Okay.
I don't know. And chapter 36, from the flesh, verse 4, Elihu considers himself as one who is perfect in knowledge. And verse 11.
Which one was that now? Which verse?
Verse 4.
35, verse 4?
Yes, sir. No, 36. Chapter 36.
Okay,
sorry about that.
36, verse 4. You're saying it's wrong for Elihu to claim he is perfect in knowledge?
Yeah. He was saying that about himself. In verse 11, just put not always true. I don't know what verse that is. And good godly wisdom for verse 22 and 36, chapter 36, is God is exalted who teaches like him. And verse 24 through 33 just is proclaiming God's majesty, which is true. And chapter 37, it seems like Elihu just came to the conclusion, just, you know, God's, you know, perfect knowledge and stuff like that. So I didn't have nothing back to say about chapter 37. And that was it for my group. Thank you.
So definitely something new. 36 verse 4. Justifying himself, right? That was chapter 35. Yeah. So that kind of goes with anger, of course, but specifically for Job justifying himself. And then what else on the negative side, or on the right side? He just, Tim kind of listed out some things that were just, you know, okay, but the thing is we've had other examples of that with the other friends. They do say you can pick out lots of verses that are true statements. So I think what we're looking for specifically is how does he, on the positive side, what does he say that avoids the errors of the friends and of Job, perhaps, you know? How does he strike a middle course? What would be a positive thing that shows he's on the right track versus just the same old track of the friends? You know, what differentiates him from the friends or from Job, okay? So those are the kind of things that would really tell us, well, maybe he has something new to offer. Maybe he's speaking from God with special revelation and things like that. Okay.
Who's next? You guys. Speak first.
Oh, that's on the table.
You said that it's in the court case. So we have the defending lawyer and the lawyer of the plaintiff.
Right. That's very good. Defense of the prosecution.
Okay, so as the defense of Elihu, I would like to submit to the court that there is extensive evidence under Article JOB 32 to 37 that Elihu is in fact quite differentiated from the other of Job's friends and from Job, and that he frequently, as is noted in the evidence submitted to the court, speaks in favor of the Lord and not in favor of Job's friends. So would it please the court to start in Article 37 of JOB? There's much note to the right, true, good, and points in favor of God, as is noted in 37:19. Elihu points out that we cannot propose a case against God because of our ignorance on many of the things of God. You can also note that in verse 14, there's good advice to consider the works of God. And in fact, he goes on to speak on this extensively through 15 to 18. He points out the wonders of God that we cannot understand, or at that time that they could not understand. You will note his attitude towards the Lord in verses 24 to 33. He basically states that they are all sitting there in awe of God, that God is amazing. So basically, he's reflecting on the nature of God and pointing out the positive attributes of him rather than accusing him. In 36, verse 15, he states that the Lord uses affliction to deliver individuals, and we see that truth elsewhere throughout Scripture. In chapter 36, verse 10, he opens their ears to instruction and commands that they return from iniquity. God instructs. I believe that it is evident that this is an unequivocal truth, again stated by Elihu.
What was the verse on that one again?
That was verse
10 of 36.
10 of 36. Where are we here? Okay. And actually, 36 verse 5, behold, God is mighty and does not despise any. We'll just glance over that. He is mighty in strength of understanding. He says that God is mighty. So again, just pointing out the attributes of God. But moving on to earlier, Job 35, verse 5, he points out how big God is. 34:28, God hears the cries of the afflicted. So he is in direct opposition to Job and stating that, yes, he does hear the cries of the afflicted. And of course, Job is in that position. Moving on to 34, verse 12. Like in verse 12, in verse 10, he correctly claims that God is just. So he's trying to point out the fairness of God and impress the point that Job is not being treated unfairly or won't be. That justice will occur and will be served. I guess one could affirm that. In 33, verse 29, he acknowledges the patience, faithfulness, and grace of God. In 33:26, speaks truth on how the Lord restores righteousness. So restores, you know, that infers that it can take time. So it's almost as if, Job, who are you to claim that this is not going to happen, or it may still occur? So he seems to have hope. In 33:16-17, he points out that God warns us and points us in the right direction. In 33:13, Elihu points out that we can't question God. Who are we to question the Lord? And that is in stark. Well, actually, that was referred to by the other of Job's friends. But and I think it was already put to the court earlier that Elihu is humbling himself in verse 6 of 33, and he defends God in 32, verse 2, in that it says, Elihu, the son of Barshel, the Buzite of the family of Ram, burned with anger. He burned with anger at Job because he justified himself rather than God. And I think that is sort of a crown statement to that the court should consider when considering the innocence of the defendant, Elihu. Thank you.
All right. I'm not going to stay in character like Stephen is. So.
Yeah, it's hard.
Now, as Joel pointed out, there's a lot of good statements that Elihu, or Elihu, however you want to pronounce it, makes about God. There's a lot of truths that he uses. However, the conclusions that he comes up with in applying them to Job's situation are false and full of error. See, first off, I'd like to point out... Now, if we if you want to turn your attention to Elihu, yeah, Elihu passes himself off as someone who is going to be gentle in his arguments. If you look at verse 7 of 33, fear of me should not terrify you. The pressure I exert against you will be light. He's saying that I'm not going to be strong in my arguments. I'm going to be gentle. However, that's definitely not the case. If you look at 36, verse 4, for my arguments are without flaw. One who has perfect knowledge is with you. And talking about premises or good truths about God, Elihu or Elihu talks a lot about God's sovereignty, about God's desire to point out man's errors, and the problem that arises from him applying this to Job comes strongly in chapter 36, verses 8 through 12. Now, in defense of Elihu, verse 10 was used. He opens their ears to correct, and it incites their they repent from iniquity. And that's true. However, if we read the entire passage in its full context, we see that there's an error here. If people are bound, starting verse 8, if people are bound with chains and trapped by cords of affliction, God tells them what they have done and how arrogantly they have transgressed. He opens their ears to correct and incite their they repent from iniquity. If they serve him obediently, they will end their days in prosperity and their years in happiness. But if they do not obey, they will cross the river of death and die without knowledge. Now, in application to Job, he's saying that your affliction is a result of ignoring God's correction. And he even, there's other passages where he speaks of this, of God using distress. A person, in 33 verses 19, a person may be disciplined in his bed with pain and consent distress in his bones. And he uses this idea that if you are in distress, then there's obviously correction from God taking place there. There's God is trying to draw your attention to a wrongdoing. And obviously this is a lack of perspective because in Job's case, as we understand, that's not what's taking place. There's suffering taking place on Job that is not a result of sin. It's simply God saying, I'm going to allow this to happen to you. And so it's a lack of perspective, in my opinion, that Elihu has.
So, Your Honor, perfection cannot be expected of a reasonable person. So while there are character flaws, I will submit that the overarching theme is one of submission to the Lord.
However, in chapter 36, I will state this again, verse 4, for my arguments are without flaw. One who has perfect knowledge is with you. Elihu, being young, has a youthful pride that he doesn't address.
I'll go ahead and say this about that verse. It's not everyone has agreed that Elihu is describing himself when he says one who is perfect in knowledge, actually. And I'm not telling you what you should think about that. But if you look at 37:16, so we're comparing 36:4 and 37:16. 37:16 says, do you know the balancings of the clouds, the wondrous works of him who is perfect in knowledge? And so the question is, when he says, my words are not false, one who is perfect in knowledge is with you, does that connect to the next line? Behold, God is mighty and does not despise any. Or does it connect to Elihu? Because it's right in between those two lines. So some people think that he's talking about God.
I would say that it isn't, because there's a progression from God to man. He says in verse 3, I will get my knowledge from a distant place and ascribe justice to my maker, and for my arguments are without flaw. So it's him saying that my premise for, or my ideas are coming from God, not my ideas are, or that this knowledge is specifically with God. Now, of course, that could be another translation error or translation, you know.
It's just not 100% clear, but it does seem to make sense that he might be claiming that God has given him a perfect revelation.
Yeah.
And therefore his arguments are, some other way of stating his arguments are not false.
Yeah.
Because God has given him the knowledge and his perfect.
Do you mind if I talk about one more thing?
Yeah, go ahead.
In verse chapters 36 and 37, he uses a lot of things such as the clouds, lightning, thunder as arguments to prove God's mystery. And something that came to mind was, we have a lot of apologetic arguments about science that we use that are quite interesting and help a lot, but we should try to avoid putting faith in these things, because if you look at 29 of 36, can anyone understand how the clouds spread out or how the thunder roars from God's pavilion? Scientifically, we understand it now. And he's bringing up a mystery that right now we understand it. And it's, so we should be humble with the scientific evidence that we bring to the table when we're talking to people and addressing people, because we don't know if, say, 10 years down the line, this idea will get disproven, or maybe the next year. So I think we should try to focus more on God's character, things that aren't changing, because you can run into problems when you talk about things like science and things that aren't necessarily exactly from That's my last thing.
All right, and his main point with those things is talking about how much greater God is than human beings. God's greater in knowledge. What human being can have the understanding of God to do the things that he does with the weather and things like that. And that is still true. Yeah, people are trying to, right? Control global warming by, you know, injecting things into the atmosphere and so forth. So that's the message. But, okay, what do we get from what these gentlemen shared with us? What other points against came up clearly? Points against, he contradicts himself, perhaps, by saying he's going to be light and gentle with Job, and then it's pretty heavy, right? Pretty strong. So that would be, did you give a reference for that? You followed up with 36.
It's 33 verses 7 is the one about him and light.
Okay.
And then 36, 4.
Okay. Claims to be gentle falsely. Okay, that would be a point against. And, now, there's a lot in here about correction, and you were talking about it, but do you? Nobody has come out and said, Elihu accuses Job of sin yet, right? Now, that would be wrong, right? If he's saying that Job is going through this because of his sin, then he's just like the friends, right? Did anybody find anything that was evidence that he does say Job is doing, this is happening because of Job's sin? Issue because the phrase there is chastened on his bed. That's different from punished as a wicked person, right? Now, Eliphaz early on did talk about God's use of suffering to chasten people, to keep them from evil and things like that. But now, with Elihu, it seems like he stopped short of saying this is punishment for sin. Over and over again, he actually mentions little things about God's use of suffering for discipline or for warning to keep a person from course they would be on, and therefore ending up in judgment, right? Can you see that happening? But does he ever make a connection between the suffering right now that Job is going through, this trial that's come upon him, and the cause of it being Job's sin, or something wrong with Job?
No, indirectly suggests that.
Okay. But he doesn't tell Job, you were arrogant, therefore this has happened, right? He's defending God now. Remember, he's defending
yes.
God. And I'm not standing on either camp here, just so you know. I don't have a pre-commitment to either side here. So, but he's in that section defending God, and one of the ways he's defending God is by saying this is how God deals with people. He uses suffering to correct, you know, to guide and warn and things like that. Right? Both, we should say, it implies you could say disciplined or chastened, right? And that could be seen as a point against, right? Because that would see a cause in Job for what has happened, right? Now, we'll handle this more in depth, but yeah, Dan.
In 36:17, Job, you're filled with the judgment because of the sins
saying is that Job is all worked up about this matter of judgment upon the wicked. He's controlled by it. He's seized with this concern about wicked people being punished. There in 23, he's saying, who can say you have done wrong to God? Man's position, God is so great, who could be in a position above God to say, tell him he did something wrong?
Like Job and his friends are all assuming, and his other friends are all assuming that he did something wrong. God really is, he doesn't have to have done something wrong to be going through this.
That's true, yeah. And Job has said that God has put him in the wrong, right? And he's implying that God is in the wrong. So Elihu's really mad about that, because who has the right to accuse God of doing wrong? His main concern is defending God. Okay, so let's keep trying to catalog one more thing.
Sorry, just in addition to that, is this an acknowledgement that Job is wicked? Job 35 verse 8, your wickedness is certain to have like yourself.
35 verse 8?
Yeah, 35 verse 8.
Well, the point again is, previous verse, if you're righteous, what do you give to God? Or what does he receive from your hand? Now that is a repetition of something Eliphaz said before, right?
Right.
If you're good or evil, what difference does it make to God? Does it delight the Almighty if you're righteous? Those kinds of things.
But then just stating outright your wickedness?
No, that's not a statement. I don't think that's an accusation that it's saying you are wicked. If you're righteous or if you're wicked, what difference does it make? How does it affect God? He's so much greater than us. How would it affect God if you're righteous or wicked? But we could put that in this category too, right? Just as repetition of the friends. Because if he's only repeating the friends' stuff, then that's not a point for him. It's a point against him. Would you agree? Okay, so that was 35, 7 to 8. Next group, you guys back there, you ready? Daniel, you ready? Oh man, we already had our bathroom break. If you gotta go, you gotta go.
Yeah.
Okay, so who's gonna speak for your group? Is it
Justin?
Rachel? Can't leave now.
All right.
Go ahead. Rachel, are you gonna come up?
No.
So this is not easy, is it?
No.
This is part of being a careful reader. And it's important with the Bible as it is with any other book. You can't necessarily just
some of the translations are kind of misleading.
And I'll explain this probably later on, but it's funny, English translations on this whole issue are extremely important, and actually I think a lot of times it comes down to there's one parenthesis. Is that the right singular parenthesis? When you have the little one of them? There's one parenthesis that can make all the difference, whether you say Elihu escapes by okay, or whether he was totally wrong like a friend. And it comes, the only one I know of that has it correct, or according to some people would be correct, would be the NASB. And it's in chapter 36 where he says he adds rebellion to his sin. Now, depending on where you place that quotation mark, those are either Elihu's words or the words of other people. If they're the words of other people that he's just quoting, then he skates by. But if they're his words and he says Job is adding rebellion to his sin, then he just made a fatal mistake. Right? So, you see why even just a parenthesis verse is that? 36. Oh no, I'm sorry, 34, 37. 34, 37.
Sorry, did you have a question?
I was going to just say, Pope Ben 34:12, he said that God doesn't hear the cry of the wicked, God doesn't hear the cry of the wicked, but then before that he says he does hear the cry of the afflicted.
Where?
Okay, well, I guess as we were going through it, we kind of realized that obviously it's like a court case, and Elihu is basically he's claiming to represent God, you know, and in doing that, he does present some truth, but he mixes it in with a little bit of his own, like, wisdom or his own opinion, which obviously is far from perfect because he himself is a man, though he may be claiming to be speaking for God. And one thing that I noticed, and our group kind of like agreed, was in 23 through 30, I think we all just kind of like thought of how Job was like in previous chapters wishing for that man or someone to put his hand both on God and man and kind of intercede. And though this chapter 33 is talking about just the view of suffering as preventative chastening and kind of talking about, like, how man's actions, like, can, how do you, like, appease God, basically, how do you be justified in the sight of God? And I guess just what I would say from these verses is that Elihu maybe is insinuating that there's something Job could do to earn, like, a right standing before God or something, but I think more so, like, what we should take from that is that it's Jesus only who can do that. It's Jesus only who can make sense, you know, of the circumstances that we go through and our understanding of God. Like, it's only found in Jesus Christ because he's the one who's perfect in wisdom, you know, and he's the one who stands in between, you know, and by taking, like, our present sufferings in light of, like, who Christ is, that's how we can, like, go forward in faith, you know, and not lean on our own partial understanding, you know, but the revelation of God that's been given to us. And, like, I don't know about, like, how this affects what's going on here, you know, but so I guess just at least there's a hope offered slightly.
So you see it as a positive thing that he does say he'll be in the end,
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like, I don't see how Elihu does that positively, because there is, like, imperfection in him. But I know that, like, for Job's sake, like, Christ will be that perfect mediator, you know? So, I'm speaking from, like, way partial knowledge here, so I don't know. But, yeah, that's kind of all I would guess I would say.
Okay, so, the friends, they said there wouldn't be a mediator.
Yeah, like, the impression I get from chapter 33 is that, like, it seems like for Job, if he would admit wrong, then God would, like, show him favor. That's just the impression I get. I don't know.
God so that you prosper. There would be another fatal error, right? Because of that.
we also found in chapter 34, which this could also be taken as a positive thing because it is true that God, like, will reward you according to your works, but this can also be taken as support for the appeasement theology or the principle of retribution. It's 34:10-11. It says, "Therefore hear me, you men of understanding, far be it from God that he should do wickedness, and from the Almighty that he should do wrong. For according to the work of a man he will repay him, and according to his ways he will make it befall him." And then it says, "Of a truth, God will not do wickedly, and the Almighty will not pervert justice." So that's just another.
Right. So let's try to get this on board then. You would say he was too heavy on the retribution principle?
I see there's definitely traces of that.
Okay. But, okay, well, so we'll put that over here. Well, as just a general issue with him. Retribution principle.
And I don't think that can necessarily always be wrong either.
Yeah, because Galatians 6:7 says, "Man reaps what he sows.
Yeah.
God has not come off, so he will repay people according to their works," right?
Mm-hmm.
See?
Yeah, I believe retribution principle, maybe go 36:11. If they listen and serve him, they complete their days of prosperity and their years of punishment, but if they do not listen, they perish by the sword and without knowledge.
Yeah. So the message there is that God is using his warnings, right? Chasing people. So they're going on their way, they get chastened. This is instruction from God, this discipline chasing. If they listen to that, then they will prosper. If they don't listen to God's warnings and chastening, then they will perish. Alright? So is that wrong, or is it an appeasement, or, you know, what is he saying to Job, say you were wrong so that God blesses you? Are you, was there anything else?
No, I'm done.
Okay. So, Rachel, you're very sophisticated. You refused to take a dogmatic stance, and you described the issues. Yeah.
I think in verse 11 of chapter 36, he's talking about prosperity and pleasantness, and that's contrasted with, if they do not listen, they'll perish by the sword. But I think so many times people that don't heed God's instruction, they live what some would consider like a pleasant and prosperous life. So that does to be seen in, you know, the peace and theology. But then again, the last part of verse 12 is a true statement, that those who don't heed the instruction of the Lord, they are going to die without knowledge. So I think so many times the Lehu will say something correct, and then the Bayad kind of say something that's off.
Okay.
But I mean, the first part is true.
So you're seeing a mixture of some good things and bad things, just like the friends. But all right, now on the mediator thing, then we do need to place that in this side or on that side, and we could place it in both if you guys want to. The mediator treatment in 33:23-28. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? For it's a good thing. Why? Why is it a good? That there is a mediator, and you're saying Elihu holds out the hope of a mediator, right? Okay, so
maybe every aspect of the mediator doesn't understand.
Okay. All right. Hope of a mediator, right? Now, some people say that Elihu claims that he is the mediator that wants to justify Job before God and hold his hand between both of them. And some people would say that's a problem, thinking he's that. Yeah. I think the whole concept of a mediator, if you take Satan as the adversary, who is the one accusing Job before God in the heavenly court, the mediator would be the one who defends Job in the heavenly court, who is able to access both God and man. And so a lot of times it's connected, like here in that passage in 33, with an angel. Kind of like the Satan is seen as an angel. As the adversary, the mediator would be like an angel or some kind of being. Now, here again, you don't have a perfect revelation of Jesus Christ as a mediator, right? But the longing for a mediator who can go between God and man is fulfilled in Jesus. So, yeah.
Yeah, doesn't he mention a lot of, like, God's sovereignty and, like, the mastery over creation?
Yes.
And, like, that's, like, a whole bunch of good qualities that they pointed out to, like, the qualities of God. God and
here we have to look forward, because there's things that he says which God himself says in basically the same way to Job, right? So if you have read once to the end of the book, and you know that God does emphasize his knowledge as being superior to man's knowledge, and his power as being superior to man's power, and connecting that to his works of creation. So God's sovereignty and master of creation, it's all through it, and that does get confirmed by God himself when he speaks. So in so much as Elihu emphasizes that, then there's no doubt he's on the right track, right? So, but look at the situation. We've got lots of things here and quite a few things over here. Maybe I've written more on this side just because it's closer to me. Anything else on either side? We didn't get, we have two more groups here? Okay, let's not hold up any group. You guys come on up and share your findings.
Well, I think most of the stuff that we had has kind of already been discussed, but just as far as the whole mediator thing, when I first read chapter 33, 6 through 8, I took it as like a good thing. Like he was kind of like coming alongside Job and trying to give him some comfort, and he was being compassionate, but reading that like in reference to the verses later in the chapter when he's talking about the mediator, it does sound like he's like referring to himself kind of like as that advocate that Job was like longing for earlier in the book, and kind of like seeing himself as like someone who could step in and be a mediator between him and God. And that probably isn't a good thing, even though it might be comforting to like think of for Job. It might be one of those things that is still not a good thing. One like pretty broad thing that we noticed was that just in like a broad sense, Elihu does acknowledge that the friends were wrong, and so he's on the right track there with because God speaks. He says that Job's friends were wrong in the way that they spoke. And another good thing, I guess, that we kind of got from these chapters as a whole was that even though Elihu, like a lot of times, he has like some strong stances on things, it kind of seems like he leaves his opinions open for interpretation. Like, he might, like, say something strong, but he'll kind of, like, always go back to the fact that God is bigger, you know, than, like, problems in it, and we won't always be able to understand. But, yeah, and obviously, as we've been talking about, like, there's some pretty strong evidence for the whole appeasement theology, like in chapter 36, 11 and 12, and then, yeah, that's pretty much it, though.
Cool, but that's good, though, for sure, that, you know, the fact that he says the friends were wrong is a good sign, right? He correctly identifies that, and now some people bring up the fact that in chapter 32, he says, I will not answer you with their speeches, okay? So he identifies them as wrong and says, I'm not going to use those things. Some people say he contradicts himself because he does use some of their similar ideas.
And also with that, I think that, like, as we have kind of been discussing, like, there are things that Job's friends say that are true at certain times. So, like, it might just be that he's telling Job that, like, most of what his friends were saying were wrong, but he might be using aspects of the truth that they had already, like, spoken. You know, even though, like, most of what they said was wrong, they had some truth in it. So he's kind of applying that.
All right, so, Jordan, are we closer to a verdict here? Or are we just getting more confused?
Both.
All right. Who's the last group? Let's hear what else you have to offer here. See if you can put the nail in the coffin or set it free.
A lot of it's already been stated. A couple things we picked out were in chapter 33, verse 3. It says, my words come from my upright heart, my lips utter pure knowledge. It's kind of a self-righteous statement, so that would be wrong on the part of Elihu. I'm going through all the wrong statements that we found. Chapter 34, verses 7 and 8. Say, what man is like Job, who drinks scorn like water, who goes in company with the workers of iniquity and walks with wicked men? And I think that is a pretty blatant slam against Job. He's basically saying, who's like you? You're walking and keeping company with all these wicked men. So he just slams his character and misjudges his character, because that's not who Job is proven to be. Also, this is a quote from Eliphaz in chapter 15, verse 16, where it says, like, I think something about drinking iniquity, like water, something like that. So he, like Joel was just saying, there are parts where Elihu just quotes his friends, even though he says that he won't do that. Chapter 36, verse 6. Is talking about God and says he does not preserve the life of the wicked but gives justice to the oppressed. And that is kind of the retribution principle, appeasement theology. It's putting God in a box, saying he always acts like this to the righteous and always acts like this to the wicked. And chapter 36, verses 11 and 12 is straight up appeasement theology. If they obey and serve him, they shall spend their days in prosperity and their years in pleasures. But if they do not obey, they shall perish by the sword and they shall die without knowledge. And we know that's obviously not true. God doesn't always work like that. The things that we found that were good about Elihu's speech, go back to chapter 32, verses 8 and 9. But there is a spirit in man, and the breath of the Almighty gives him understanding. Great men are not always wise, nor do the aged always understand justice. So he is acknowledging that any wisdom comes from man. And just because you're old and you have gray hair and lots of experience doesn't necessarily mean you're wise. And vice versa, just because you're young doesn't mean you're a fool. Chapter 33, verse 4. The Spirit of God has made me, and the breath of the Almighty gives me life. Just acknowledges that God is the giver of life. 33:29-30. Behold, God works all these things, twice, in fact, three times with a man, to bring back his soul from the pit, that he may be enlightened with the light of life. And right before that, Elihu was talking about how God will put people through trials and suffering to get them back on the right track. And that is true. God is very merciful. He will put us through a bunch of hardship to get us right with him. He doesn't delight in the death of the wicked, but in repentance. And 34, verse 12. Surely God will never do wickedly, nor will the Almighty pervert justice. That's true. God cannot sin, and he cannot pervert justice. And 35, verses 7 and 8, he's talking to Job. It says, if you are righteous, what do you give him? About talking about God. Or what does he receive from your hand? Your wickedness affects a man such as you, and your righteousness a son of man. So basically he's saying, who, by your righteousness or your wickedness, you don't add or take away anything from God. So God is sufficient in and of himself. He doesn't need us at all. That's all I have. Anything I missed? Conclusion? Is that this? You gave me?
Yeah. He's Elihu's not any different. We found that he's really not any different from the other three.
Mm-hmm.
In the essence of his argument, he was still holding to the appeasement theology. He was still holding to the retribution principle. He just seemed to have a clear understanding of the attributes of God, while he emphasized primarily the justice of God, but nothing different.
And it's difficult because you hear a lot of the same words, but when you really look at does it do the same thing with those? Does he do the same thing with those words as the other guys did? You guys say yes. Yeah.
Yeah. God knows
Yeah, and it's about like how you respond. That's what he's saying. It's a warning. So how are you going to respond to it when those things happen? So like when he talks about, you, a lot of people mention 36:11-12. Okay, there again, the argument is that these things happen to the righteous as chastening, and then it's a chance to either respond properly and prosper, or ignore those warnings and continue on toward destruction. Same thing when he says he does not preserve the life of the wicked. That God doesn't specially intervene to bless wickedness and preserve those people's lives. So he's definitely upholding the retribution principle in the sense that God does bless the righteous and does punish the wicked. He upholds that and says that is true. Why would he do that? Why would he come along and, say, and affirm that God does bless the righteous and punish the wicked?
Because ultimately, in the end, he does.
Yeah, and who's that an argument against, though? He would say that against the friends or against Job? Against Job. Remember, because he's justifying himself rather than God. Elihu's saying, God is just. He does bless the righteous. He does punish the wicked. Now, what kinds of things does he say against the friends? He doesn't say, every time in this world you see suffering, it's punishment for wickedness, right? He doesn't actually say that. He says that these things happen for reasons you can understand, but they, you know, God uses things for other purposes too, like chastening, discipline, warning, right? So that's how he kind of says things that are different from the friends. So, right? So, see, because the friends, their error in Elihu's eyes was that they condemned Job, saying he was wicked, therefore he was being punished, but they couldn't prove that he was wicked. And so he says this could just be a mysterious discipline kind of thing, which should be taken as a warning, and you should respond to it that way. Yeah.
Basically, because he emphasizes God's sovereignty, and also he shows in essence how man is going to be able to fully understand it.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be things that man isn't going to be able to fully grasp why things are happening, but you just need to understand God has everything in control.
Mm-hmm.
So faith in that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's generally true. So right now, if you had to make issue a verdict on Elihu, would you say that he was wrong, false, bad, and it's man's wisdom? How many of you would say that? Really? Tom? Tom still committed to that view? Anybody? Nathaniel?
Yeah.
Okay. In other words, when you hear Elihu, you would not say, we're hearing from God, this message is from God.
Well, not fully.
Not fully. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, my big thing is he still started from the wrong starting point. Right in the beginning, he's accusing Job of this great sin, keep accompanying the wicked people. He's right along with the other three.
Okay,
Job, there's some sin in your life.
Before we let that go, that quote right there is from chapter 34. And again, this is the section where those quotation marks are all important. Because what does he say? Here's where that appears. Men of understanding will say to me, Elihu, and the wise man who hears me will say, the quote starts, Job speaks without knowledge, his words without insight. Would that Job were tried to the end, because he answers like wicked men. And then the question is, do you stop the quote there, or do you keep it going? For he adds rebellion to his sin, he claps his hands among us, plural, I think that's a misunderstanding, and multiplies his words against God, end quote. I believe that would be the correct thing. So he's quoting from what the other wise men would say about Job, which they have been saying, right? So, again, it's really iffy, isn't it?
I think there's two charges on the table. One, doctrine, and two, position to God, relationship. I think not guilty in assumptions about God, but guilty in terms of that doctrine.
Yeah.
So applies Job's righteousness.
He does seem to imply this, at least, right? That
he says that outright in 34. This is at 34, the whole section, 5 through 9. He's quoting Job, and then he makes a rhetorical statement about what he feels Job's position is. 5 for Job, he said, I am in the right, and God has taken away my right. In spite of my ear, I am counted a liar, and my womb is incurable, though I am without transgression. What man is like Job, who drinks up scoffing like water, as he quoted Elihu, who travels in company with evildoers and walks with wicked men? Because he has said, it profits a man nothing that he should take delight in God.
Well, Eliphaz actually said he drinks wickedness like water. Elihu says he drinks scoffing like water.
I got scoffing in this one.
And
that's the biggest problem I've had, is I'm looking at all these different trends.
What I mean is, though, when Elihu says it, he says he drinks scoffing like water. And Eliphaz, before, he said he drinks wickedness like water. Okay, so the difference would be that Elihu is saying that in speaking this way about God, justifying himself rather than God, putting God in the wrong, putting himself in the right, he's speaking like a wicked person. He's talking just like wicked people talk. All right, but does he stop short of saying that Job has actually sinned like a wicked person? Right? And that's where you see those little fine points that are
wise.
Yeah.
I think a lot of
what
I
think
is right and it's the way that
him. Okay, yeah. And some people would say that he had the right doctrine but the wrong attitude. Yeah. So that would be one way of seeing it. So how many of you guys wholeheartedly say, if I was there, I would have been just like Elihu. I would support him. You know, I think he was right. He was speaking from God with divine revelation or whatever. You know, just basically, how many of you think he was good? Okay.
A few. You know stuff about God, but like you have to work through your flesh. Basically, like you have the Holy Spirit in you, so that's not going to make everything you.
Okay. All right. Righteous anger, sort of like Jesus overturning the tables and driving people out of the temple. Maybe like there's something. Some things are you're right to be angry about,
like
sin. Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. And then you would like the who was it that brought up the verse? The anger, the wrath of man works not the righteousness of God. Right there. I mean, it would depend on how. That was you, right? Tim? Yeah, from James. So you see, look at that verse and say, okay, how do we interpret that, you know, in light of the fact that there does seem to be a place for righteous anger. And of course, any human effort, angry or not, can never accomplish God's perfect righteousness. So, yeah.
I think the fact that in the end, the only one God says spoke correctly of them is Job, mm-hmm. implies that the rest were, you know.
Somehow came up short, or. Now people handle that issue in a few different ways. Some say Elihu is ignored because he just repeats things and he was bad just like everybody else. He's irrelevant, basically, and that's why he doesn't get mentioned by the Lord. Others would say he doesn't get outright condemned by the Lord because he had a mixture of good things and bad things. He didn't quite commit the same errors as Eliphaz and the other two friends, so he didn't deserve God's condemnation. But he also fell short of saying the right thing about God that Job said. Okay, so he was like in between, and there was a mix of, you know, he didn't quite go as bad as the friends, but he didn't go as good as Job, and so he just kind of is left out of the Lord's mention. Some say, well, it's just an addition that, you know, later author put in there anyway, and so it's not part of the original, and that's why he's not mentioned.
So, I mean, the real question is, did Satan use him like he used the other three?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Or did God use him to encourage
him? Yeah, that's good. In the context of the whole trial, the test, was he helping God's cause or helping Satan's cause? Was he serving to influence Job to appease God and reveal that his motive for worshiping and fearing God was self-interested? Or was he serving to strengthen Job to hang in there to the end and not give up? That's a great insight. Yeah, that's what the question really comes down to. Because we look at every other character and think about it that way, right? Job's wife, she said, oh, your blessings are gone, curse God and die. God loses. The friends said, appease God, you know, basically lie about your own sin so that you get your blessings back. God loses there too. So where does it allude or align it in? That's a great question. Yeah. One last thing and then we'll...
I think the only thing you could really say that he actually uses Job of is arrogance. Pride.
Yeah.
At least, you know, again, there's room to kind of weasel your way out of it. You don't know. He doesn't actually accuse Job of that. But... that's the only thing that he actually has a strong, strongly implying on Job, that you have arrogance, stop talking, you know, if you
important in everything we deal with the dialogues to look at the introduction of the prose introductions in chapters 1 and 2. We get a little one for Elihu, which explains why he's angry with the friends, why he's angry with Job. So those are kind of our guides to sort out what's going on in between. Next week, we'll actually go through and finish up analyzing it. Hopefully come away with a conclusion. Let's see. All right, God bless you guys. We're done for the day. Next week, one thing you need to do for next week is read the Good Friday article in your course guide. It's in the back. Good Friday article in your course guide. That point in the conversation. What does that say about Elijah's content? That question open, whether Job is righteous or not, he kind of leaves that open and just says, in hypotheticals, here's how he's defending God. Job, he feels like Job is accusing God of wrongdoing, and so his main issue is defending God's righteousness.
But is this are those verses even correct people? Yeah. They really bother me.
What bothers me about 35:78 is look at 22 verse 2. He knows where the friends went wrong, and he's trying to avoid those errors, but he's also seeing how Job is being, he's going too far and implying that God is unrighteous, so he's wanting to correct that as well. And so he has to show that if Job is suffering, it doesn't mean God's unrighteous, because God can use suffering for the righteous. So that's a defense of God, to say that God can use it for correction or warning. This may be a step forward, but it still misses the point. And that's why I think one of the very likely things for me is to see Elihu as the best that human wisdom can offer. You know what I mean? But still still not quite, he doesn't have the divine revelation of what happened between God and Satan still. He's not working with that knowledge. So he represents Israelite wisdom and the best that humans could offer apart from divine revelation. Because he knows that it doesn't just mean you're wicked, therefore you're getting punished if you suffer. He knows better than that. But he also knows that Job needs to see that he's accusing God falsely as well.
Job and God, they agree on a lot of stuff, but God knows a lot of things, right?
Yeah.
They bring out a lot of points.
They're
like, why are you?
From me! You can see their line. God's wisdom and God's knowledge and God's power.
And then have some sort of divine revelation because of that book.
Yeah. Now, here's the thing. Just because God comes and speaks, when he speaks, he actually doesn't, he doesn't reveal anything of divine right to Job. He actually points Job to things within the world which Job should follow a certain conclusion about God. So when God shows up and speaks, he doesn't say, Job, this is what you should, here's some divine revelation for you. Satan brought this up, accused you, so this was a test. He doesn't go there at all. So he points back to, you can observe the creation, but I am all knowing, all powerful, my ways are higher than your ways, basically. So you've got to trust. God's help to correctly interpret what we can see that has been revealed and to be able to follow it correctly. He doesn't reveal the heavenly realm, basically.
Which
God
is
interesting.
Oh, I think that he doesn't say that. Because that would be easy, like, hey, this is what happened.
Right. It's like for the test to be successful, you got to look at all the evidence and really look in to see which way you take it. But all these things are like somebody's interpretation of what they see there. And you can piece them together in different ways.
Well, it's good to discuss. Like, I feel like we don't have enough discussion
classes. Yeah, and the difference is like, I think I could sit here and tell you both sides. What I think and what I think you should think. But when you actually work it out for yourself and struggle through it, then I think it's easier to do better. So, but the hard part is like, when you have 42 chapters to get through, like today we didn't really advance.
At all.
We just investigated. We investigated and we didn't advance, so that's the trade-off, is not able to cover the content. But, ideally.
Yeah, it's worth it.
Unless you want 6-hour classes every day.
Thank you.
It was worth it. Definitely a good section. You want to talk to me today, right?
Yeah. I was just going to ask you about, everything, after here, right? Because I'm here,
yeah, may the Lord give you wisdom. There's also online options, you know, like you could get an accredited degree from Faith Seminary, a bachelor's degree in religion. They transfer everything from here, so you get 2 years worth of transfer in. They would also take your English classes, and then you could finish up with their general ed stuff online. And it's really easy. It's fairly expensive. You know what? I can email you the college information packet. You know, we put together a list of different schools that can transfer something.
Yeah.
So I'll send that your way.
Okay, thanks.
Yep, you're welcome.
Good. I'm just not the smartest person in the world because I know I have to get up really early, at like 10 till 5 on Tuesdays, and I still stayed up to like 12:30 last night.
Yeah.
I just wanted to, my wife was there, and I just wanted to hang out with her. Yeah, it is good, but it hurts. It hurts the next day.
Somewhere in the Bible says, like, dark sleep.
Yeah, don't love sleep unless you come to poverty.
Yeah. How's your stuff going? Is your car all set now?
Yeah, it's still going, man. I'm sure it'll be something else. I got a raise at work, so I'll be able to manage this stuff.
That's good. Are you getting enough hours and everything? Has that been consistent?
At work?
Yeah.
It's only 8 hours a week.
Okay.
But it's Friday night, I made $300 cash.
Wow.
You know,
you get tips and stuff too, right?
Yeah. I keep the tips now because the club hired me and they took out the middleman.
Oh, yeah. Sweet. That's good. Man, that's ideal. Even what I had here as my ideal. I should get away from my phone.
Say anything incriminating to the whole campus.
I had pizza delivery when I was here. And so I had a car and I would go to work for like 3 hours. 12 hours a week, but I made double what I was on the hour. I made like 12.
By the way, I'm sticking with my phone.
Yeah,
I
can do
it. As long as it's not hitting your road. The final thought I had was, you know, what's the significance that in the middle of all this mess, at the end of Elihu's argument, that's when God shows up?
Yeah.
And what does that say about Elihu's content?
Yeah. Some say that it's basically Elihu is foraging into territory that he's not able to handle. This is something that has to be handled by God only. So God just swallows up the end of it and just, you know.
It's like of all the things that happened, of all the people, he's the one that crossed the line?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I don't know, because there are so many things that prepare the way for the Lord's speech. Mm. And the question I want to ask as I look at it is, assuming that it was the same author and it's a unified word, which it doesn't actually have to be, inspiration,
right?
But I just feel like going to speculating on stuff like that, and there's no evidence of any different compilation. Like, there's no manuscripts that don't have the section or anything like that. So
yeah,
I don't go there basically. But like, why is it there? What's the function of it? What's the purpose of it? And how does it help with the revelation? So yeah, I think it goes further than the friends, you know, because he's avoiding their errors,
right?
Does a pretty good job of that, I think. I think there's even the points where it seems like he lines up with them, he actually avoids those same mistakes.
Yeah.
Condemning Job as a sinner, being punished by God without giving evidence. He doesn't actually list any of Job's crimes.
Right.
Yeah. He says that they said he has rebellion for his sin.
Yeah.
I am pretty sure that he's quoting them, because that whole thing makes sense only if it sticks together. But, you know, if it wasn't the case that he's quoting them by saying he has rebellion to his sin, then he makes the same mistake.
Right.
Because
Job were the same?
Yeah.
We're both men.
They're
yeah.
suffering the same plague.
But it does seem like when he says one who is perfect in knowledge is with you, he's talking about himself. I do think he's one.
Yeah.
He claims to know. He claims to have complete knowledge of the situation. So, that's interesting. Yeah. I think maybe I would say that he's the best human wisdom. Because, you know, best human wisdom that can be offered because he progresses beyond the friends. He's not limited to their understanding and their need to condemn Job as a sinner who can punish. And he also sees the problem with Job being so overconfident in his innocence that he's willing to put God in the wrong.
Yeah.
You know. So, but still, he's not God.
Interesting.
And his attitude probably has its faults, I would say.
So you have the worst of man's wisdom contrasted with the best of man's. And then Job would be he would be contrasted with God.
Yeah, he's the sufferer, and so he's got that unique perspective.
Right.
And I think the triangle does help, where you've got Elihu's defending God, right? Because he's not saying, like, okay, because from Job's perspective, if he's punishing Job and Job is innocent, then God is unjust. So Elihu has to answer that. And then he also has to answer why the friends are wrong, you know, as well, in order to defend God successfully. And I think it's true that that's his main concern, is defending God
right.
against Job's accusations, and because Job's the main one who's defending God, because the friends are kind of defending God too, but they're mainly in the camp of the retribution principle. They're describing the world.
Right.
This is the way the world works. When you see a person suffering, there's wickedness.
They're not defending the right God.
Yeah. See, I think they're looking at, this is how the world works, retribution principle. Elihu's saying this is how God works, retribution principle, which actually is true.
Right. In the end.
In the end. And about his character, that he does, you know, that's how, he would be unjust if he rewarded wickedness and punished righteousness. So, you know what I mean? So,
yeah.
And Job is in the camp of his own righteousness as his overarching concern.
Right.
He doesn't really seem to care if God's putting it wrong. He just knows he doesn't deserve this, you know.
Yeah, but Job's content was... as attested to by God, the most accurate.
But there, I wonder, because the Lord says to Job, would you put me in the wrong, put me in the wrong in order to justify yourself?
Hmm.
And that is an
his
accusation.
His conclusion was wrong, but his content was right about God.
Yeah,
he
but,
still
when,
spoke
but when,
correct.
And that's the thing, is if God can say, would you put me in the wrong in order to say you were right, then the way Job has been talking, there are errors there.
Right.
In his emphasis, at least, in his concern. So when God says, they have not spoken about me what is correct as my servant Job has, did Job only say that correct thing, which they didn't say, did he only say that in his final response?
Right.
When he says,
oh.
I spoke of things I didn't know.
That's right.
I spoke of things I didn't know. He's acknowledging his limited knowledge. Compared with God's, he acknowledges limited power compared with God's.
Yeah.
But when he says no purpose of yours can be withheld from you, is that the key?
Yeah.
That God can do whatever he wants,
right.
basically.
And that's the only thing maybe that he spoke correctly.
Yeah, and I think that's the one thing his friends didn't say, the other guys, that God can do whatever he wants. He's not limited by the principle of retribution. They said God always has to reward the righteous, not the punish the wicked. You know, I think that might be.
And Elihu didn't touch on that?
Yeah, that's the question. Did Elihu say that one thing, that no purpose of God? I think he advanced a little bit, and then he said God has purposes for suffering that aren't limited to punishment.
Hmm.
He can use it for discipline, warning, correction, chastening, right?
Right.
So that was, he progressed, but...
Job put the cherry on it.
Job actually said it correctly, and I don't think Elihu did. So if that all fits together, then I think... Elihu just didn't go far enough, as far as Job did. Confess enough.
Very interesting.
So we'll see. I will next week try to go through and handle those particular.
Well, I couldn't figure out your position. You're good at
presenting
it in an unbiased way.
Uh huh. Yeah, to let people work it out.
Yeah.
Step by step. Yeah. No, to be honest, there are gray areas, and it's still hard to have my mind. What I just described to you is probably, I said probably, because I don't know, I suppose, but I should think. I some would say that when it says Job did not sin with his lips, it implies that he did sin with his heart throughout the trial. There's some Jewish commentators who say,
we know he sinned.
Job sinned in his heart. Then Elihu's a prophet that confronts that correctly and speaking for God. And